Hi, everyone. Thank you very much. I'm James Neeswand. I'm from Illyriad Games, and I'm here to talk about CRM in gaming. CRM is a very interesting area, and I'll go into why in a second. But hopefully this will work. Who the hell are we? You've probably never heard of Illyriad Games. We're a small, a tiny indie, about five people. We've been running for 6 years, a UK-based company. We have a couple of titles, one title that's in release. It's going to be 5 years old in February. And it is a massively multiplayer HTML5 MMO. The game is 5 years old now. It's been running for a long time. It's in HTML5. It is a massively multiplayer game. That's critical. What I'm talking about here in CRM and gaming is purely from the perspective of massively multiplayer games. Whatever kind of games that you make, if you make iPhone app games, you will have different experiences and different things to base yourself on. Hopefully you'll get some takeaways from what I'm talking about. We do very persistent games. It's a very long-term game, by which I mean it'll take you about 3 months of play to get out of the tutorial. The average player length is 2.6 years. It's a very slow-paced game. This is by design, because it gives us a lot more opportunities to actually engage with our customer. I'm going to use the word customer and player interchangeably, broadly, throughout this presentation. So when I talk about customer relationship management or player relationships, it's the same thing. Epic and deep is terms that are usually used about Illyriad a lot. It's a very, very in-depth game. We focus very strongly on social interactions. It's part of our ethos. It's part of our game design philosophy. We have a mantra that we set out when we first wrote the game, which is that there is no content that we can create as game designers that is as compelling as the content that players themselves create. And I'll talk about why that's worked for us and how it's worked for us. It's a free-to-play game, but we do not allow pay-to-win. We cannot allow pay-to-win. If you imagine you're engaging a customer for an average of 2.6 years, you can't have a new player arrive with a credit card and have a winning situation within weeks, just because they have a lot of money. So we're very microtransaction focused, but we don't allow anything, any purchase in game that significantly affects gameplay. Despite that, it does pretty well. Our next title coming up, I'm only telling you the kind of games we make so you can see where we're coming from and see what I'm going to talk about in CRM and how it's applicable. It's also an HTML5 game. It's also an MMO. It will be launching in 2015, I hope. That's certainly the plan. It's an ever-changing date, as we all know. It's a space-based MMO. If you've ever played EVE Online or something similar, that's where we're coming from. It's a persistent world. It's in WebGL, which is a technology that's come of age, we think, or at least we hope. You can get into it straight away, as this demo is showing, from the browser. And you're straight away in space. There's no plugins, no flash, no silver light, nothing. You're in space combat. And it runs on Azure. Our first game we built on Microsoft dedicated servers. This one we're building entirely in the cloud, simply because it's the only way, as a tiny indie, we can get the scalability and the cost flexibility of servers on demand. It's on a whole new scale of gaming. As you can see here, this is a demo of 50,000 spaceships in space. Each of these can be piloted in real time in the same combat, so with Twitch gaming. So we're going for a whole new scale of stuff. We do public demos every second Saturday. Next one is not this Saturday, but the next Saturday. And you can just turn up with a web browser and play the game if you want. It's, again, fast-paced. It's, again, going to be epic and deep. It's, again, going to be social-focused and, again, not pay to win. Because, again, we want a long-term engagement with our customers. We're very awesome. We win lots of awards. We get a lot of press written about us. You probably, as I say, haven't heard of us, but we do keep quite a low profile. Not intentionally. It's just as quite hard as a five-person indie sometimes to get suitable recognition of our awesomeness. But we have just won in December the Player's Choice for Grand Strategy Game of the Year for Illyriad. That was 120,000 votes from the public, so we're very pleased about that. And we won the Editor's Choice for Best Community. That's the one we're actually most proud of, because that is the culmination of 5 years of very careful social engineering to get the best community. And whilst, you know, we don't ever want our players to believe that they are being nudged and pushed and we are using behavioural psychology to get them to be a very nice and welcoming community, but we do. And this is largely all I'm going to be talking about right now. I'm using graphics from the game. Our art director, Nathan, specialises in propaganda art. So, you know, you'll have to just take some of the quite disturbing images as they come. What is CRM? Really, the basic definition and the stages of a typical CRM project. If I ask my wife, now, there's a purpose behind saying this. I've actually been in this building before. My wife was head of CRM strategy at Experian, here in the next door office. Experian, the world's largest consumer data agency. They know more about you probably than Google does as a whole. They know more about your actual purchase and what you really do, not just your aspirations. So she was head of CRM strategy there, and my CTO, Ben, was head of innovation at Experian. So we have quite a lot of experience commercially in how to monitor, measure, report, analyze, and move into predictive analytics and work out what our customers are going to do and nudge them towards the behaviors that we want. So if I ask my wife, who's very, very nice, she says that CRM is about understanding your customers enough to properly engage with them. She'll also say that CRM is about anticipating customer needs. Because she's very nice, that's marketing speak. I think CRM fundamentally is witchcraft. It is about the system's real goal is to better understand the customer, the player, than the player understands himself. It is to wickedly use this forbidden arcane knowledge, this insight in behavioral psychology, to get them to buy things or do things that they don't yet know they need to or want. And it's to do all of this without totally weirding them out. This, and that's a very important fact, because if people realize that they're being nudged, if people realize they're being pushed in a direction, they very much rebel against it. So it's there's a reason there's a behavioral psychology unit in the Cabinet Office to influence the way that people in the UK behave. Note that you never want to ever see the workings of that unit. Government never want you to know that. I know I sound like a terrible conspiracy theorist, but this is the focus of CRM. As far as I see it. This is the slide that I probably put the most amount of effort into, so this is the one I'll spend most amount of time on. This is the stages of CRM. This is information optimization. Immensely clever quote for me, which is from hindsight via insight to foresight. Hindsight is reporting. This is looking at what happened. It is looking at your players, what they do, recording everything they do, every button that they click, everything that they say in chat, everything that they do, and reporting on it historically. But you need to build a model. This is analysis. You need to work out why your players are doing things, and you need to make assumptions. And those assumptions will come from very peculiar aspects. There's a lot of deep dive data in your analytics end. There's a lot of ad hoc queries and query writing, where you will be saying, well, hang on, why does this group of players engage better than that group of players, either as a group or as an individual? And there are lots of strange things that you will discover in your data that will help inform you. And partly that might be where the player came from. Did he click on a banner advert, or did he read a very positive review in the press about your game? Was he invited? Was he a referral? So source is important. There's also the actions of what players actually do in your game. Are they more cooperative or are they more competitive? Are they highly PvP focused or PvE? Are they traders or are they diplomats? Again, depending on your game, your decisions will be different. But you are recording all of this data and you are writing ad hoc queries and analyzing why to build a customer model. Then you have to put all the data that you have through that model and see whether it works. This is monitoring. This is real time. This is actually changing your game on the fly to individual requirements, to what is best in your perception for that player to do next. And that can be in something you want them to do, a point of sale. Now is the best time to try and get them to buy your in-game currency. Or now is the best time for their alliance to make peace with the alliance they're at war at. These are all things that you can nudge, and you may or may not want to, but you can certainly influence the whole characteristic of your community by using these tools. The final end, the most difficult end, because your value is on the left, it's on the y-axis, and your timeline, foresight, as well as difficulty, is on the x-axis. The most difficult one to get right is predictive analytics. This is where you can, using your models, using some very good mathematics and algorithms, work out players' propensities, their likelihoods to do certain things depending on what they've done in the past. And this is, you know, unfortunately, quite a cynical view of the world, but it is an accurate one, and it's used an awful lot. So there's building the CRM model. This is building, essentially, what your players look like, what you want to record and why you want to record it, and what you can do with it. We started out with a very simple player model when we first went live with Illyriad. We were logging their source. You know, did they come as a referral? Did they come from search? Did they come from a review? Did they come from the Windows Store or the Chrome Store? How did they arrive at us? And we'd record that against them. Then we'd look at what they did in the game, their gameplay-oriented activity. And that was what they were actually doing in the game. Were they trading? Were they finishing the tutorial? Were they trying to fight other people? Basically, what kind of personality group, a segmentation they were fitting into. So again, a very simple model. And we did a small amount of personality type analysis. This was originally looking at the kind of things they said in chat. You know, if someone uses every letter on the keyboard except the ones with letters of the alphabet on it, they're a certain personality type. If people use negative phrases a lot, again, you can start looking at and building a personality model of your players. And player value, and we initially expressed this in purely monetary terms, because what you're doing is you're saying, these are my players, and this is what they do, and this is your what I know about them, and how valuable is that to me? And initially we just said, well, how likely is that they're going to spend money with us? Which is, you know, obviously if you're making a game, unless it's for a charity, you are trying to make money. Nowadays, we've moved on. We assign player value on multiple criteria, and I'll talk about that in a second. We assign propensity scores, so it's not just putting people in a bucket called PvPers versus PvEers, or hardcore versus casual, or traders versus diplomats. We look at their gameplay activities, what they do, but we assign propensity, so their likelihood to go in particular predefined segments of the kind of gameplay that we're looking for them to do. We also have how much they are willing to cooperate and how much they're willing to compete in different circumstances. One of the things that we discovered with our player base is that Illyriad is an ultimate PvP game. Your 2.6 years of effort in our game can be undone in 3 days without warning. There's no Care Bear zone. There's no non-PvP zone in our game. It is an ultimate PvP game, and you can be sieged out of the game. So it does have a sort of a mutually assured destruction element to it. And that has actually been quite instrumental in getting our players to prefer diplomacy over warfare, because they all know the consequences of a server alliance war, and they'll be terrible for everyone's 2.6 years of effort that they've put into the game. So we model against that. We also model personality in a much more in-depth way. We took Cattell's 16 personality factors, and I'll talk about those in a moment, and we reduced that set down, but we also included communications analysis. So we begin looking at how players communicate, how they talk, even in private. We don't read their private chats. it using our game chat software. But the server does, and the server can tell the mood of an alliance by what they're talking about, by looking at certain phrases, certain words, certain combinations, frequencies of things. So we can often tell now whether an alliance is going to go to war in the next 2 months, even before that alliance has decided that they're going to war. We have a propensity score for that. We can work out by what's being said, by the attitude of the group of players, as well as at an individual level, what kind of mood people are in and where they're heading towards. Out of game sources of data, people log in using their Twitter handles, we'll look at their Twitter feeds. And again, the system will do this, and it will, again, assign scores, and it will rank people and put them into different criteria and propensities based on not just what they do in-game, but also what they're doing on Facebook, talking about our game, or Twitter. System does all of this, but our customer managers can manually adjust the scores. So whilst we are making assumptions about people and scoring them according to our defined criteria, this can always be overridden by the community managers, and they can, when we're looking at a person's CRM customer profile in-game, things can be adjusted. So we might have a big list of why we've decided that this guy is 40% more likely to be a role player than this guy. Now, we know that because he chose orc or dwarf as his starting race. If you choose human or elf, you're much less likely to be a role player. This is just a fact that we discovered in our data. If you choose orc or dwarf, which are the much less wanted races, as far as people, when they're given the choice of race to choose, they are more likely to be role players if they're orcs than dwarves, than elves, than humans. So we can begin to score that in, and we factor it. We know that players who are referred to us by another player in a big alliance are much more likely to stay with the game than they are if they clicked on a banner advert. So all of these scores are put in and automatically collated, but the community managers can override them and make decisions based on individual things. But the system will then learn and change its weighting and its biases within itself. So it continually reassesses our model, the assumptions that our model has about our customers. So we now have moved into deeper models of customer behavior. Multi-matrix value scoring. This is what I was talking about, assigning a value to a customer. It's easy to do pure monetary value. It's much more important to look at the marketing value of a customer. A particular player might give you £50 worth of in-game currency, and that's great, and that's important. You want that. But I would much rather that player gave me £5,000 worth of his friends coming into the game. That's a much stronger effect for me and for the game. And so the marketing value of a player is actually more important to us than the monetary value, because the marketing value, marketing begets marketing, players beget players. And so we assess this directly and indirectly. So a player's value is not only how much money they give us, but how much money did their friends give us as well. What's the ripple effect in terms of monetization? And what's the ripple effect in terms of marketing? So, for example, our key thing here, where monetary value and marketing value come together, is in the top right corner. Alliance recruiters and alliance managers are our most valuable players, by a long way, because they bring new players in and they retain new players. They also reduce a lot of pressure on us to assist players and do support tickets and queries and answer player questions, because they actually ask their alliance leaders rather than us as the development team. So we don't have to write quite so many help files if the alliance leaders are writing them for us. There are lots of other different categories there. Down in the bottom left, you have your trolls and the whiners. Every game has them. You just have to deal with them. But most players are sort of somewhere in that bottom left quadrant between spending a bit of money and helping out with a bit of marketing. But we try and move everyone into that top right quadrant. And there are lots of ways of doing that, which I'll talk about in a minute. Our personality model, our 16 factors of personality, we went and talked to some behavioral psychologists about how to model personality in a mathematical sense. There is no real 100% answer here, but there is a certainly a model that's worked for us, and this is pretty much it. We have a whole bunch of scores here that go from pretty much many of the major functions that make up someone's personality. And so, for example, you've got their level of independence, which, you know, is whether how social they are versus how much of a lone wolf they are. We have their emotional side, which is how calm they are versus moody. Their intellectual side, analytical versus instinctive in terms of their gameplay. And all of these factors and everything they do in the game is fed into the CRM system and builds up a model. One of the things that we had to deal with early on is how much of that model is based on role-playing and how much of that model is actually based on the person themselves. Because obviously when people are playing a game, they represent a persona a lot of the time. And we actually decided that it didn't matter. Because the only thing that matters to us and our players is the persona being presented. So we're not building an actual personality model of, you know, whether you are intellectual or whether you are emotional, but the persona that you're putting out there, how that fits, how that builds up, how abstract is your thought process, how concrete is it, what's your level of anxiety, your trust, your self-doubt, and all of these things come together to basically look at what is inside the player's brain. What are the ways... How can we nudge players? How can we take these models of data and actually move from predictive analytics, what they will do in the future, to prescriptive analytics? How can we not just guess what they're going to do or have a propensity or probability for what they're going to do in the game, but how can we push them towards those things? This is essentially areas of behavioral psychology that have been built into the CRM system and into the game design and the interface. We're all aware of these. The existential nightmare of the human condition, it's, you know, thinking's hard and we're not very good at it. That's just a truth. People's brains, we all love to believe in the rational aspect of everything we think, that we're made up of rational thought and rational decision-making processes. But there are lots and lots of tools in behavioral psychology that you can use to nudge people in particular directions. The cognitive side, cognitive biasing, you've probably heard, I don't know if anyone's read Daniel Kahneman or any of those sort of nudging books. There are lots of them out there in sort of business studies and pop psychology books. But things like anchoring, where you can essentially... anchoring is a system whereby people give excessive weight to unimportant but salient points about something they're considering. Priming is where you can, by talking about something and using certain words and neuro-linguistic programming techniques, you can make people think better of it when you come to the question. It's the reason why when political polls go out, the actual formulation of the question is almost the most important thing, because you can nudge people towards saying yes or no in answer to the question by the way the question has been posed. So there are All of these cognitive processes, the gambler's fallacy. The idea that if you toss a coin, 50-50 chance, and it comes up heads, and you do it again, and it comes up heads, you do it again, the chance that it's going to come up tails is higher four times in a row. It's not. It's still 50-50. But we have a belief, the way our brain works, that this is the way the world works. And it's important to clock these kind of things. There is a game, I'm not going to mention its name, but it was an MMO, and as a new player, you were given a sword, and your sword had a 50-50 chance of hitting when you swung it. And they were losing a lot of players, and they didn't really know why. And the answer was they were rolling a dice 50-50 every time. They were flipping a coin. So the first time that player walked out into the field of gold-shitting squirrels or whatever it was in this MMO and swung a sword at a squirrel, 50-50, miss. Again, 50-50, miss. Again, 50-50, miss. And after about four or five times, which is statistically, you know, 1 in 16 for 4, 1 in 32 for 5, players were saying, this game is broken and quitting. And so you never roll a random number in a game. I mean, you know, you roll 50-50 on the first swing, and if it's a miss, you roll 75-25 on the second swing, and you roll 90-10 on the third swing, because people expect on a 50-50 sword the third or fourth or fifth swing to hit. But that's not actually the way probability works. And so these sort of areas of behavioral psych are things that you should build into your game to nudge people in those particular directions. That's cognitive bias. There's the availability heuristic, again, very important part of the way people think. This is a bias that we have towards making seeing patterns where they don't exist, or using heuristics, a pattern way of thinking, without using easily retrievable mental shortcuts, essentially. So, say for example, the question is: are there more words in the English language that begin with the letter T than begin with the letter K? You don't even have to think about it. The answer is there are more that begin with the letter T, because you can instantly pull up in your head lots of words beginning with T. Beginning with K, you know, less easy. You know, keep, kitchen, kelp, kleptomaniac, Kalamazoo, kangaroo, lots of words beginning with K. But that heuristic can work against you as well as for you. For example, if you ask people what's more prevalent, the letter K at the beginning of a word or the letter K in the third position of a word, the availability heuristic tends to make people say, well, the beginning of the word. Because, you know, kelp, kitchen, kangaroo, Kalamazoo. But it's not true. There are actually three times more words in the English language with the letter K in the third position. But we don't see that instantly. Lake, take, fake, acknowledge, lots of them. But we don't instantly think of that because our brains don't work that way. The availability heuristic works against us in that situation. And again, there was actually two elements of sort of cognitive psychology going on there at that particular time, because one is the availability heuristic, and the other one is I primed you by my first question by giving you a list of words that begin with K, kelp, kitchen, kangaroo. And by repeating that a couple of times, when I then ask the question, are there more words beginning with K than in the third position, you're more likely, because you've been primed, to say that's true. So these are areas that you need to build into your games, because they are the way of nudging people using the models that you've built into particular ways of behavior. There's also cultural bias. This is very obvious if you think about the prevalence of games made in the Far East and how often they're played in the West and vice versa. But there are different ways of thinking for different cultures. We don't all think the same, and it's one of the sort of failures, I think, slightly of behavioral psychology in the West. It's called the weird. Most psychological research has been done on Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic nations, the weird demographic. Not that much research has actually been done on the ways different cultures think. And they do think differently, and so that's something you need to be aware of, especially if your game's an international one. How to build that in. The strengths of the drivers. This is what we've discovered to be true. Of all the things that drive thought, this is sort of Immanuel Kant meets Antonio Gramsci with a bit of Durkheim in there. You've got your rational thought at the bottom of your pyramid. Everyone likes to think they're rational. And you've got the illusion of free will. But you've then got your hegemonies and your biases in the middle. You have your cognitive, your cultural, your environmental biases, all of the things that make up. But the most powerful of all the ones that we use in our arsenal of trying to influence players is the social bias. The social bias is really, for us, the strongest one. That's often gets a bad rap. Everyone thinks about peer pressure when you start talking about social psychology. It's also, you know, the sense of belonging in a group. But there are, again, lots of effects and lots of psychological things there that you can take advantage of to influence people's actions, activities, and behaviours, to nudge them towards things that you want and away from things that you don't. Lies, damned lies, and even more damned lies. Statistics. Statistics are important. They're one of my favourite cartoons from XKCD. It's quite geeky. But the thing about statistics is that they're actually, it can be quite hard. And you really do need to know what you're doing with statistics. You don't want to be using them wrongly. There's nothing worse than having wrong information. It's better to have no information than to have incorrect information, incorrect assumptions. And don't be afraid to get professional help. I mean, if you're doing statistics or a talk on behavioral psychology, you probably need professional help anyway. But don't be afraid to talk to a statistician, because when you're building these models, you are making a lot of assumptions, and statistics are incredibly helpful in building them. Benchmark against an index. This slide, as I say, is very, very boring. Benchmarking against an index is when you compare different scores of different propensities on a customer model, you need to be comparing apples with apples. And it almost doesn't matter what your index is, whether you score people out of 500 or whatever, but it needs to be consistent in its scoring across the things. Otherwise, it's almost impossible to make comparators. So comparison scoring is very important. You need to apply it consistently, and you also need to regress test against it. If you modify any of the variables that make up your score, you must regress it. Go back against all your historic data and make sure that whatever the model is coming out with is consistent, correct, and makes sense in retrospect. A cognitive bias that we all have. We all look for confirmation bias. We all want to find data that agrees with our existing viewpoint. It's a danger. I mean, it really is when you're building a customer model to say, well, actually, I think customers think like this, and it's not always the case. And so you really need to have it reviewed by as many people as possible. And also, don't be afraid to go to experts if you need to. Because there's no end of people at universities who will help you for the price of a nice lunch in the pub. I mean, genuinely, that's something we discovered by talking to psychology departments all up and down the country. Take them out for lunch, they're thrilled. Put their name in the credits on the game. It's brilliant. You've had the best time that they're going to have all year. And they can put it on their next grant renewal called I Help the British Game Industry. Genuinely, you'll get lots and lots of people willing to help you. Just talk to them. And also, don't be afraid to introduce new indices. Whatever you think a customer model is never finished. You can build your customer model, you can populate, you can say, yes, I know lots about my customer. It's never the full picture. It's never completely correct. It's, at best, a indication of the areas that you are making more right decisions about propensities than you're making wrong decisions. But always feel free to introduce new assumptions and new indexes for your players. So level of confidence. This comes to it's almost the same point, but it's slightly different. I don't want to go all Donald Rumsfeld about known knowns and unknown knowns and all the rest of it, but there is a point there. Much as it pains me to say it, every assumption you make, every value that you assign, you need to be aware of your level of confidence of it, and you really should be aware. It's something, again, that's very easy to miss and say, I know this player and this player is this kind of person. People don't fit into those categories. They fit into probabilities of those categories. The world isn't black and white, and your data will never give you deterministic truths. Unless your truth is, did my player buy my in-game currency yesterday, then you have an absolute data point. But it's very rare. And in these kind of models, it is shades of grey rather than anything being black and white. And margin of error is awesome. Know what your margin of error is in every assumption you make. And test it. Again, statisticians will be able to help you with this, but it's well worth it. So how has CRM worked out for us? I mean, we've obviously built this amazing system. Just some numbers. Over a three-year period. Why a three-year period rather than a five-year period? Well, our first 2 years of running the game were spent collecting the data. Now, you don't have to do that. You can sit down and take it more seriously than we did when we first wrote the game. We first wrote the game and we wrote a game that we thought everyone wanted to play. I wrote a game that I wanted to play. I mean, that's essentially where how I got into the game industry. I was so bored with games. And I wrote a game that I wanted to play, and I assumed that everyone else wanted to play that game. Now, that's not true. That's not the case. I'm not everyone. And so it's only over a three-year period that we've actually been looking at how people interact with the game, not only what they like about it, but what they don't like about it. where they drop out of the game, when bad things happen and when good things happen, that we've built quite a substantial module. We've had more than 300,000 players go through the game. And as I say, a lot of them providing, on average, 2.6 years worth of data. So, using this, our cost per acquisition has dropped from $1.42 when we launched the game to 0.6 cents. That's how much we now costs us to get a player. We don't spend a penny on advertising. We stopped advertising 18 months ago, and we get more new players than we've ever had back when we were advertising, wasting money on banner adverts. Not saying that banner adverts is a waste of money. There are lots of good reasons to do it. It has helped kickstarting it. But all of our players now come from referrals and press. You know, that's it. It's where we focus our efforts. And the cost of us doing that is tiny. And the retention that we get from the players is huge because they've come in from a trusted source. You know, they've come in from a referral. The social pressures to enjoy the game are actually much stronger than us saying, this is a really fun game, you must enjoy it. Or even actually making a really fun game. People are quite willing to play games that aren't very fun because all of their friends are playing them. You know, this is a truth. Our average player session length has risen over this period from 42 minutes to 2 hours 10 a day. Because the game is much more engaging. Our average player retention was terrible. As I say, it's a very long-term game. A lot of people come into a game like Lyriad thinking they're going to instantly have fun. As I said, at the beginning, it takes you 3 months to get out of a tutorial. It's not everyone's cup of tea. But our targeting has now got that much better that we retain nearly 30% of people beyond the first 30 days. Our conversion rate from being a purely free player to a monetized player has risen from 8.4% to 24%, just under. So nearly a quarter of our players now actually monetize, which is great. And our average revenue per paying user has risen from $22 to a current of $186. Now, that's, you know, this is funding our second title, our existing game. And it largely runs itself because the system alters itself. It does endpoint, not A-B testing, but A-to-N testing. It does all of this stuff automatically built into it. It modifies itself and makes based on the assumptions and the new data points that are coming in. So, the future. This is, now that we're doing Age of Ascend, our second title, we're spending a lot more time than we ever did on building an artificial intelligence model for our NPCs, our non-player characters. And we had a sort of epiphany where we realized that we already had very good mathematical models of how people think, how their personalities are, and what decisions that they make, what trees of actions, what choices they make in certain situations. And we have that in numerical form, called our customer relationship management model, our customer model. So why don't we use our customer model to run our AI? We've got lots of mathematical data about how people behave in the situations that we put them in front of, either as individuals or as groups. And so we're now feeding this customer data back into the AI model for our agents and our non-player characters. Not in terms of speech or anything, that's, you know, well beyond the remit, but in terms of, do they choose to fight or flight in a combat? To what extent does this alliance or faction take into account fear or strength in numbers or all of these factors? And we can model it on real player behavior because we have the numbers from the customer models of either individual customer models or social group models like alliances and so on. So that's sort of where we're very focused on in the future. We're also moving away from, with Lyriad, we run everything in our own dedicated servers using SQL Server, and we're moving everything into the cloud and hopefully Microsoft Dynamics as a way of doing it, and sort of Hadoop and stuff like that, which I'm not going to go into. Questions and maybe answers. That's sort of my summary of you know, what we're doing with CRM. I would say, probably straight out, before, in case anyone does ask, is this the way that you should do it? Probably not. I come from a lucky position where I'm married to someone who runs CRM strategy for Experian, and their tech guy, the head of innovation, so is our CTO. So is this something everyone should do? No, but it is certainly stuff that you should research. You should consider it, because in your game design process, as you're from scratch, you should be building in not only the touch points with which you engage with your customers and recording them, but also those points in the process where you can influence them and make them, or not make them, suggest them, nudge them in particular directions that you want them to go in. Because the sooner you put that into your design, your game design, the better it is. The more comprehensive it'll be, the more joined up it will be as a full system.
Hi. James, yes. Fascinating talk. I'm really interested in the opportunities with the selling of the sort of license of the analysis of your game data. Mm. So is that something that your company do at the moment? Do you license your intelligence?
Do not currently.
No.
we do not. And it is something we've been thinking about, because it's not only the insight that we have based on our players that we currently have, i.e. the models themselves, but also the analytical engines and the software and the algorithms that run behind it. That is something we are thinking about, and this is kind of slightly a testing the waters talk on that, because if there is a genuine appetite for what we know, or at least what we think we know and how we've done it, then we're very happy to talk further these topics.
Kind of on that theme, it might be worth having a chat with Gina Jackson, who's taken over on the Next Gen Skills Academy. Mm. And I know Gina's doing some work to pull together a research pool. Mm. And I think, I know that's not quite selling it, but
we're very happy to share. We're very happy to share within the bounds of not giving away the commercial advantage. But we're HTML5. We're open web people. We're on the W3C HTML5 gaming committee. We contribute to the Kronos group. So yes, we're very happy to talk about this. We're very happy to share specific insights and bits of data. If you wouldn't mind, that'd be fab. Anyone else have any? Yes.
I was just interested because you gave all the data points, but in terms of the kind of core demographic, I'm guessing it's quite a narrow demographic that play your existing game, or not?
No, funnily enough, we're 52% male, 48% female, which is a first shocking statistic that everyone's very surprised at. And again, it's the community. It's a very welcoming community. We don't have that many trolls. We don't have that many hardcore sort of, I'm going to seed you out of a game people. It's a very welcoming community. That's something that with the whole game design we've very heavily focused on from scratch. For example, there's an excellent sort of feminist gaming blog called womenfightersinreasonablearmor.com, which basically is all about you doesn't have to be a maiden in a chainmail bikini. What about Brienne of Tarth? Come on, let's do this right. And we tapped into that very early on. Our community manager is a woman. It's something that's very, very important to us, is to have it as a welcoming and inclusive environment. Our demographics are quite interesting because it is a slow-paced game. Average age is 36. 42% is university educated or better. 48% female. 50% Western European. 50% North American, 30% Western European, and 20% rest of the world. But it is a very... Illyria, our current title, is a very English-centric game. It's got a lot of words in it, a lot of words. We're just publishing a book on the lore, the e-book, because So it is very very weird focused to Western-educated, industrialised, rich, and democratic. It is all English language. Age of Ascent will be very different because that's much more visual. It's a space combat simulator we're building a lot more localization in from the get-go in there.
Do you think it'd be slightly more
male-oriented? I don't know. My assumption was when we started Lyriad that the fantasy genre was going to be almost entirely, entirely male, and that's just shows how sexist I am, really. I guess, you know, it was my assumption that it was going to be a sort of a Tolkien geek fest of men, which is kind of, I guess, where I come from. But it hasn't ended up being that at all. Out of, for example, our alliance leadership, out of the top 100 alliances in the game, which represents about 8,000 people, about, actually, it's a majority, 54 of those top 100 alliances are run by women and have female leadership councils. There are all women alliances in the game. There are, you know, it's, we're very proud of it. I mean, very proud of it.
You don't know that they're definitely women,
though. To some extent, we do. To some extent, we do, because we actually do, within our propensity model, and I don't want to go into it, but we do make a distinction between actual gender and stated gender. Stated gender, obviously, people can choose gender when they come into the game, but we could very quickly, again, through linguistic analysis, largely make about an 80% probability of whether this person is actually a woman or is actually a man. So that helps. Obviously, the minute there's a payment, a PayPal name comes through, or something that's validated by a third-party source, then suddenly the gender becomes more clear. So within about 15%, we believe, and again, having tested this, we took a lot of data and ran it against Experian's Mosaic database, and we kind of know that within about 14-15%, we know accurate real gender rather than just stated gender. But yes, and there is, as I say, a big difference between the real personality of someone and their roleplay personality, and we have to be aware of that. But as I think I said, we kind of realised that it didn't really matter so much to us, because it's their stated, it's how they present themselves, it's the perception of them that actually is the key thing. Perception is reality.
I've actually got a proper question as well. I'm interested in cloud-based gaming, and I'm looking into developing a game at the moment. I'm just deciding which of the games I'm going to go forward with. So you were talking, there was quite a lot of the technical stuff to take in there. There's quite a few bits, so I might have missed something a little bit. So you've got the first game.
Illyriad.
Yeah.
Terrible name.
That's working on servers at the moment.
Yes.
That's quite a slow-paced game. And then you've got the new one, which is probably sort of medium-paced, Age of Ascent.
Yeah.
And is that working on, what sort of servers is that working on?
That's 100% on Azure.
That is absolutely on Azure.
Illyriad, our first game, is mostly on dedicated servers.
Yeah. So my kind of question was, I'm looking at doing a more fast-paced action game.
Mm.
And based on what you've done on Azure so far, what's your opinion on doing something like actually kind of running awesome. As much in the cloud as possible?
It's absolutely awesome. Lee knows that there's a Microsoft white paper published about Age of Ascent, and I'll send you the link to. Some of the stuff we're doing there is quite, you know, pushing the boundaries. 50,000 people in a single real-time Twitch battle. You know, that's stuff that you're not really seeing that much. And on Azure, the amount of data, the throughput we're handling, when we did the 50,000 player test, we were handling 267 million application messages a second. You know, we were handling more data in a minute than Twitter does in a month. And that's really cool. And there's no way we as a tiny indie could do this without.
Yeah, because I'm looking at having hundreds of players in one environment together.
Yeah.
And running as basically what Lee and yourself has already mentioned, any device can access it.
Yeah.
So I'm looking to what ends I can.
Absolutely. Well, we can talk about this.
I can get to the end.
Yeah. 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 Absolutely. Basically, for us, it's been great. And if you want to test the waters and try it out, the BizSpark program. I don't know why I'm banging Microsoft's drum so much. It's your cloud gaming day. But BizSpark is a great system.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice because it's scalable. The idea is to get things going. So with Age of Ascent, how many kind of simultaneous players have you got?
Well, we've scaled it up to 50,000.
Yeah.
In a single battle. What we did is we actually got 2,000 real people to fight a battle, and then we replayed that slightly offset in space and time from lots of computers to make it up to 50,000.
Is that just an arbitrary limit of 50,000?
No, it's just how many servers they were willing to lend us at the time. It was how many servers they were willing to lend us at the time.
Nothing. I want 10 times that amount of players.
Yeah, 750 cores, I think it was. We had a core limit for the engineering team because it was on the same day that Titanfall was going live, and apparently Titanfall was more important.
Yeah.
Terrible. Sorry. I... cool. Any other
questions? Hi there.
Hi.
Good talk. You listed some pretty impressive stats over the 3-year period piece. Yeah. Player session length, retention, conversion rate, ARPU. Just wondering, was there an order of operation there? Were you kind of chasing any of those as a North Star? Were you focused on improving any one stat, or were you kind of just looking at all of them and continuing? I'm just interested in your strategy there, because obviously there's probably trade-offs you had to make at the time.
Yeah, we focused on community was our number one focus. Actually, to some extent, to the detriment of gameplay, we were focusing more on the 10% of people who made it to the end of the second week or whatever, and we were saying, well, actually, let's make sure that they're happy and engaged and stay for 2.x years. And now we've shifted our focus back to let's make sure that 30% of people make it to that point and then stay for longer. But we focused on the community side first. With the game design, a lot of sophisticated alliance management tools, private chats, public chats, global chats, alliance forums, you know, everything that could encourage alliances to, within the game environment, rather than stepping outside of it to use TeamSpeak or Chatsy or whatever else, that within the game environment could do all of their communications, all of their mailing needs, all of their scheduling, alliance management, you know, war operations planning, all of that stuff. We focus very, very strongly on that because we started with a build it and they will come mentality. And that was probably a bit hopeful. So having built it and got quite a lot of them coming, but not quite as many as we were hoping, we then moved on to acquisition as more important, which is why I say it's only the last 18 months that we haven't spent any money on advertising, because that system's now ticking along and growing and running, the player get player referral programs and focus on press and reviews and the stores. I mean, the Windows 8 store has been certainly in the last few months fantastic for us. Again, here I'm promoting myself. The Chrome web store has been brilliant as well. about 40, 50% of our players now come from the Windows 8 store and it costs us nothing. You know.
Last question, anybody?
Anyone?
Thank you, James.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.